Welcome to the Audible Genius Podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes look at being a musician. I'm Joe Hanley, and today I'm talking to Peter Dyer, a keyboardist, musical director, and sound designer. We'll be talking about what it's like to play keyboards for big acts like Mariah Carey and the American Idol House Band, what being a musical director for artists and bands entails, and what to do when an artist asks you to make the music more purple. Let's get started. So, Peter, you do a handful of different things. You're a touring musician. You work in studios. You do some commercial scoring and sound design as well. And one of the first things I want to talk about is your touring experience, which, you know, you've worked with a lot of acts, a lot of big successful acts, like the one of the biggest being Mariah Carey, other slightly smaller acts, but still well-known like St. Vincent, Adam Lambert. Mm-hmm. Is there a big difference for you, for your experience, when you're touring with like a mega star like Mariah Carey versus the other acts?
Oh, just in general?
Yeah, like is the experience as a gigging keyboardist different with a massive act like that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. They're, I kind of started backwards because right out of school, I got the Mariah gig because of an audition. Turn this down. And so I like started on this huge gig, and then I got used to like the other tiers. yeah, Mariah's got this huge, as with all mega pop artists, they've got a big apparatus around them to make the machine, you know, work, from the crews to the production team to the people that help the artist. You know, there's more employees in that than like the entire apparatus that supports, you know, Adam Lambert just for the road, you know, let alone her label and all that stuff. But yeah, it's quite a difference, and it's a different experience. And yeah, I enjoy both.
So with someone like Mariah Carey, do you get to just show up on stage? Everything is set up for you. It's just sitting down, playing, and getting up and walking out.
Somewhat. I mean, we show up on, you know, sometimes things run late. But okay. I'm on time. So, yes, there's text. There's more text to like help with keyboards and backline stuff. Okay. Very different than, you know, say if I'm playing for a buddy in LA, I'm just dragging in through the back alley, you know, my keyboards and my stand.
Right.
Yeah, that's part of that apparatus. Let's see. Yeah, I had five keyboards on stage, and they handled like the backups and, you know, all the cable management and all that stuff. And
yeah,
that would be as I go to the other artists, not to speak down on them. They're, you know, I love all these artists. That more of those responsibilities come on me. And I actually enjoy being in charge of my rig and making sure it's okay and stuff. Cause then I know it's pinned up, but, I did learn to trust those guys handling for me. So.
Oh, cool. So was that, so like after Mariah Carey, when you went, maybe did a slightly smaller artist that, didn't have as much tech support, were you a little like,
definitely, yeah. So she had her kids, she had twins around 2008, and so we just stopped for like a year there, except for maybe a few private gigs, and so I was jumping back into the other stuff. I thought I was booked out on this long tour, and plans changed. So immediately after that, I was on a gig where I was running playback and doing keys, and also kind of being like the techie guy on stage, because it was just me and the artist and a guitarist. That was lots of learning experiences there too, because as I said, I kind of did it backwards. Like I came out of school and had this huge experience right away, and then I started to, like, you know, learn the hard knocks ropes there.
Right.
For real, got spoiled, and then, you know. And that's when I started learning how to do playback, which was like a really valuable skill for me throughout my career, because I was just forced into it. They were like, hey, can you do this? Can you also do this? And by the way, can you also do this? Actually, on that tour, also the guy who was driving, who was the tour manager, he was like nodding off and falling asleep on the drives. And so I was like, look, man, I'm just going to drive, you know, like half the time here. So yeah, driver, crew guy, playback, keys, you know. from like, you know, and the other situation with Mariah where it's like, you know, a car shows up and gears there and yeah.
When you say playback, what do you mean?
Playback as in doing playback tracks, playing tracks out of the computer, support tracks. That can range from like tons of support, like almost the full track, to maybe it's just a percussion loop, depending on the act.
Okay.
And then making sure that system is routed correctly to the house, the front of house, for the sound. And that could be anywhere from just running off an iPod, like just a 1/8-inch jack out at something, you know, very low key, to I've been on gigs where I've done playback and we've had 64 channels of digital audio over Matty running to front of house streamed, where they have control over all of those elements. So the whole gamut, making sure that system is working, communicating with the people that you have to work with to get those channels going, and also redundancy, which is a big part of running playback, and making sure that if that system fails, well, making sure it doesn't fail, essentially. So I had two laptops and like an A rig and a B rig. And if the A rig went down, God forbid, then you jump over to the B rig, which was running simultaneously, and hopefully the audience is none the wiser. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So they're both playing at the same time, but you can only hear one. So yes. If one fails, yeah. It's just a switch over to the one that's playing.
And this happens all over the biz. Like there's, okay. I mean, the idea is you don't know that it's happening. So I've got lots of friends that do playback full time. I don't do it much anymore. The redundant systems, especially like say for the Super Bowl or the Grammys or something like that, you know, there can be no failures, no hiccups at all.
Right.
So they have like ironclad redundant systems. So,
okay. Yeah. So do you ever do playback and live keyboards at the same time?
I did. Not anymore really. Thankfully, but because it's high stress, but yes, I did that for a while. I've done that with Adam Lambert, St. Vincent. And, I did it with Mariah a little bit when, there was a dedicated playback guy on that. And there was a couple times a couple sections of tour where he was booked, and so I ran it, and I had got some gray hairs during those times.
But, I bet because you got to think about what you're playing and then kind of worry about monitoring the playback.
If something goes down, you're, you know, where's my free hand to like solve the problem? So it's almost every act now, it seems like, has that. It's common, and there's way better systems, and everything's smaller. Now, you know, this was like 10 years ago or so when I was starting in it. So the technology has changed and adapted, thankfully.
Okay.
Macs are a lot better now, you know.
Go ahead.
Let's see. And ideally you have redundant systems. Some folks don't want to, you know, that's a whole nother expense and thing to handle. So especially like younger bands or newer artists, they don't always want to invest in that. And then it's fine until it, you know, bites them in the butt on some show or something. I don't know if any of the kids here will remember, but the infamous Ashley Simpson SNL moment was kind of like a behind the veil thing of when the playback, you know, went wrong and everybody's looking around. How do we handle this? What's going on? The audience, I don't think, understood what the problem was. They're like, "What? Oh, that was weird."
Or if you go further back to the famous Milli Vanilli. Where it got stuck on the loop, right? Just kept singing the words over again.
Oh, yeah.
Nightmare. So then are you given, in the cases you have to do both, are you just like, okay, here's the recording that we made in the studio. We're going to play this live. Do you have to pick, like, okay, I think the computer should play this stuff back and I'll play this live? Like, are you making those choices?
So that's another job I do more often now than live keys, is music directing, they call it, where you're, or like band leader, where you're making the choices for the band, and you're the connection point to the artist. Because, and I mean, it depends on the artist. Some artists speak tech fluently in this stuff. Like Annie Clark with St. Vincent, she knows everything. And she's like, well, I know this pedal and that pedal, and this is coming out of Ableton. She's fully in it. And then other artists don't have a clue about it because they don't have to. So it's the music director's job to like translate and communicate and solve those problems between the artist and the band. I started doing that as like on the road when I was doing playback and keys and figuring out that job. Making those decisions and seeing what worked and what didn't on a gig. You know, maybe there's too many tracks coming out and like then the band's smothered or there's not enough tracks and we need to build some more. Like on some albums, if the stems are really slim or not powerful, you know, maybe for the live show it has to be beefed up or made larger than life. So then I'll add tracks or I'll make production tracks at home to add to it. It just depends on the situation.
I've always found that interesting because I've heard that before where you've got the individual tracks from the original recording session and yet when you play them on stage they're maybe too thin or they're too muddy
or something.
Is there any rhyme or reason to that, or is it just you try it as is, see how it sounds, and adjust?
There's definitely a live element that's different than the studio, and it's interesting to see the difference in understanding because you talk with the producers that never leave the studio. That's where they live. That's what they're masters of, and they won't understand that like the live element need sometimes these moments need extra power or more dynamics or it needs to come down or something, because the track, especially if it's like pretty dynamicless, it can sound great in the club just slamming from a DJ, but like once you get a band involved or if you want something that has dynamics up and down, then you can't work with like a brick walled track that's just 808 all the way through. It adds to the drama. I mean, it's like theater versus a movie, maybe. I don't know.
Do you have like a sense ahead of time? Like if you're given some new music, can you kind of tell at this point, like, oh, that's going to need help or that's
going
to be.
Yeah. Best. I've gotten better and better at that. Yeah.
Okay. In the beginning, was it just like a mystery or like, let's just see what happens?
I guess with any of these things, just experience has taught me things and learning from people and mentors and friends that have been doing that as well. Different genres maybe need some more doll ups or hypeness live versus others. And that's part of the excitement. That's why people go to live shows, right? Otherwise they just listen to the album at home. I'm sure you've had the experience where you listen to an album on headphones and you're hearing all these details. And even sometimes still, like I'll listen to a Radiohead album and I'll hear something in the back that's like, oh wow, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. But like live, they're trying to give a totally different experience. It's not a headphone experience. It's an emotional, like dynamic live experience.
Because I would imagine like those little subtle things that can be layered into recording that are still wonderful to hear on the headphones. Do those get completely lost in a live situation?
A lot of the time. Yeah, totally. Okay. Yeah. Just frequency wise or whatever. Like especially if it's a huge PA, like some stuff's just going to get lost. At home it could be drowned in reverb and sound beautiful and lush, and you put that in like a theater where it's blasting and it just turns into mush, because at for live the vocal has to be just slamming, the crowd's making some noise all the time, they're getting excited, there's echo, there's all sorts of different things to deal with in translating from album to live, and that's the music director's job, is to help translate that experience.
Okay.
It's not to like change it necessarily, unless the artist wants to have a totally different experience, which does happen. Right. And that's fun. Trying to get it communicated since the medium's different. It's not headphones.
Do you have to be more selective about like which elements of the track you're gonna pick?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And like you said,
strokes. Bigger, more expressive moments. Because on the record, like a little change or something will seem big, but when you're in a live thing, I think those strokes in general have to just be bigger.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's fun. I really enjoy it.
So. It sounds fun.
Now, for our listeners, part of adapting music to a live environment is sound design, where you're changing or creating sounds. And a big part of sound design is synthesis, the art of designing sound with a synthesizer. If that's something you want to learn how to do, I highly recommend Syntorial, a super effective course that we here at Audible Genius created. It'll take you by the hand and start from the very beginning, showing you how to program a synthesizer. And it comes with a built-in soft synth that you'll make hundreds of patches on as you progress through the course. By the end, you'll be making your own sounds intuitively and completely by ear. And for our loyal podcast listeners, you can get 20% off Syntorial this month using coupon code DIRECTOR. Check it out at Syntorial.com.
When you said sometimes the artist wants to take a real different, is it sometimes drastically different, or is it more subtle vision change?
Maybe it depends on the gig for the artist. Like I've done several different arrangements of like Firework for Katy Perry over the years. Chris Pooley is her music director, and sometimes I'll help out with stuff. But if the scenario in which she's performing changes, then the music needs to change. If there was a fashion show thingy where we made it more dancey and kind of slimmed it down because it was like an elegant fashion show type deal, as opposed to like the stadium show that's just like bang bang, you know, loud, okay. Big right. experience. And then I helped build her Vegas show with Chris Pooley and did some of the arrangements, and that she wanted to like reimagine some of the songs completely so that they were more fun. Cause she was going to, the show has a theme to it with like a storyline about, I won't give any of the details away for people that want to see it. Great show. But it's got a story that goes. So the songs are adapted to kind of play like a score in some ways rather mm-hmm. than, your regular 90-minute concert of like, here's the hits, here's the hits, here's a ballad.
Okay.
Here's a little, yeah.
Oh, it's interesting.
Yeah. So it's fun when you get some license from the creative team or the artist to reimagine something, and you get to try out something new.
And when the artist is communicating to you as a musical director, does she tend to speak in more broader sort of human terms and less musical technical ones, and part of your job is to sort of translate it?
With some artists, absolutely. Yeah. It totally depends on the artist. Some of them don't speak, techie or whatever, because they're not supposed to. That's your job or my job. They don't speak drummer, you know? So the music director can talk to the drummer and help translate, like, okay, how are we getting this? Say this artist describes a feeling or mm-hmm. something, then you can translate that to the band how to execute that.
Do you ever run into... Go ahead.
Oh, and then some other artists will be very particular if, like, say they've come up in bands, like, Annie Clark, St. Vincent, she's been in charge of her own band and been playing in garages, you know, since she's young, so she speaks like band per se, you know?
Okay.
So she can talk about amps and chords and things like that.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. Yeah. Have you ever been in a situation where the artist has communicated something to you in more broader terms and you've just been like clueless? Like, I had no idea what she meant he meant.
Absolutely. Yeah. I remember somebody said more purple once. And I'm like, okay. what do they want? Maybe that means like mellower? Okay, let's try that. Nope.
That's a really good example.
I mean, it's the classic like miscommunication between different departments. That's like directors and scoring guys. Same thing, you know.
Okay.
They don't know necessarily how to communicate because, again, they're not musicians. That's why they hired you. That's your job, you know, to take their ideas and translate it to the music. Mm. So there can be the whole range of experiences there.
Wow. Now, you said that you got this Mariah Carey gig right out of college. Mm-hmm. So you kind of jumped right to the top. How did that happen? How'd you get that opportunity?
So I let's see. I went to Musicians Institute in LA for a year. Actually, I got a gig with this guy, Van Hunt. He's a neo-soul guy from like the... He had hit in the early 2000s. Great artist, amazing artist. Love working with him. And so creative. So I dropped out of school actually to go play with him and do this tour because I got his gig. And Randy Jackson was his personal manager. Randy Jackson from American Idol. Randy Jackson, famous producer, bass player, musician. So Randy got to know me through that gig because I was touring with Van Hunt. And then Van Hunt's record got dropped. Like the label dropped him and everything quickly disappeared. And I was like, oh, shoot, I thought I was made. I thought that's how it is. You get the gig and then you're set for life. That's not true? No, it's not true. You're going to have to play for 1,000 different artists, Peter. Yeah. I went back to school actually for half of a term. And then Randy called me about halfway through the term at school because I'm like trying to figure things out again. He's like, hey, I'm putting together a new band for Mariah Carey and I want you to be in it. So then, yeah, there was an audition, but I definitely had the, you know, it's like, it's who you know. That's who I had the connection for with him. And so that's how I got the Mariah gig. And I played for her for, let's see, 6 years.
Wow.
And, that's a recurring experience in the biz for, I think, everybody. It's all who you know in a way, you know. You have to be prepared for those moments.
You just have to be in the right place at the right time.
Exactly. Yeah. Be in the right place in the right time. But you have to also be ready in those moments. Right. You know.
So would you say an aspiring musician should kind of say yes to everything just to kind of be out there connecting?
That's what I did. When I went to school at MI, I signed up for like there was a billboard with like local bands, like, come play with this and that and this. I went to every jam. I signed up with bands. I just did everything. Some were terrible. Some were wonderful. Mm-hmm. Cause I just needed the experience. So, I've thought this before. I almost, the degree, which I didn't actually get, I never finished school, was whatever. But like what I got, what I paid for essentially was like the network in a way by going to this school. Cause I was surrounded by like-minded people who were all trying to get into the industry. And that's where you meet people and find yourself in experiences.
That's cool.
I could trace so many of my gigs back to connections I made through those times.
Oh, wow. So then were you just kind of getting plunged into this big league? Were you super nervous? Like, did you feel like you're in over your head?
Absolutely. Cause some of my classmates had the other experience. They get out of school and they're like, oh no, what now? I had the other thing and then her tour ended. And that's when I had my, oh, what now moment. That's when I had to go back and like work my way up again, in a way. I forgot the question.
So when you were plunged up to the top like that, did you feel in over your head?
Yes, absolutely. Well, and there's all the politics and the experiential things. You're just thrown into the fire. Like so many terms that I didn't know. I didn't know how many managers there were. You know, I thought, well, there was just one manager. There's a production manager. There's a tour manager. There's a lighting director. There's a video director. There's a creative team. There's like all these different leads and... So yeah, I had to slowly figure out, okay, who's in charge here? Who do I talk to about this? It's a complex mechanism. As I mentioned before, like the apparatus of that, like say for any of those, Ariana Grande, Bruno Mars, Mariah Carey, these large acts, to make that happen, there's a huge team and of specialists that are all doing their thing. And so it took a while to like figure that out. And then there's other acts where there's, you know, 14 people total on the road.
Right.
And that's, you know, everybody, including the artist. So I'm thankful for the experience because it just threw me into the deep end.
Would you say you like touring?
Yes. Yes, sort of. I toured my brains out in my 20s, which was fun. I got to see the world on somebody else's dime, play amazing music, meet amazing people, grow as a player, and you know, garner all these experiences. Mm-hmm. And I've been on some brutal tours that like are just beatdowns of you know, on the body and on the mind. So those can wear down. And then other ones that are just wonderful, beautiful experiences. Mm-hmm. So I'm thankful for it all. I like to not tour now because I got two kids and wife and family here. So I actually have not really toured in a few years. I mean, of course, pandemic too. But I've been doing more production and scoring and music directing for bands from just in town, like all, which is where you go and rehearse the band and set them up, arrange the show with the artist. And then the band and the artist, they go out and do the thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You might do some tune ups over web or something like that. That's actually pretty common now. I do that a lot. And like Adam Lambert, for example, so I was keys player, keys and playback in 2015 and 2016. Toured a lot. And then since then, I've been his music director, not playing keys, not doing playback, because there's a playback person, there's a keys person. And so I just arrange the show and direct the band, handle those kinds of details in town. And we'll do some rehearsals to prep the show and then send them off. And then if there's changes, he'll hit me up and be like, can we try this a different way? And then I'll address that as it needs addressed. Maybe some new tracks need to be made or you have to communicate something to the band. So you're the point person for the musical translating.
Wow. It's almost like a consultant, like a live consultant.
I guess so. Yeah, in a way. Yeah. You're the point person to the music department in the way that like a lighting director would be the point person for all the people that actually handle the, you know, the lighting cables per se. You know, the lighting director's like, we're going to have this here and that there. And then the other people go execute it. So, yeah, I've not been on the road since, on a tour since 2017. Yeah.
Oh. So that's kind of the best of both worlds, right? You get to do the musical directing, which sounds like a lot of fun to me.
It's fun. It's intense and it's a lot of work. And, you know, you're the one up till 3 a.m.
Right.
But then I get to work from home. And then you get to work with a lot of other artists because when you're a keyboardist, say, on the road, then you're doing that for 3 months or whatever. And this way I'm able to work with music direct for multiple bands all the time. There's more creativity usually in those moments, which I enjoy. Some of the acts recently, like this summer I worked with Lil Nas X for his tour with Chris Pooley. And Chris Pooley's a big music director in LA, so he handles a lot of those acts. So I was working with Chris on a Lil Nas X tour where there was no band. And it was all track, but they had amazing video content, custom video content made, and big dance crew. So it was almost like a theater type thing. And again, there was a story that was kind of threaded through the set. And there'd be these interludes and monologues over video, kind of like a fantasy world type thing. And so, like, it involved like some string arranging and orchestrating and stuff, as well as like hip hop. 808 stuff.
Wow.
It was fun.
So then were the videos already made? And then you're like, okay, these are the videos. You guys need to kind of make the music.
No, they were, they'd be like, what do you call them? Just cards like of images from the creative team. words spacing me right now, but like drafts, mm-hmm. Just like you would for like a, like say an animated movie or something like that, where
like a storyboard.
Storyboard, there it is.
Okay, there it is.
Need another coffee. It's a storyboard. Storyboards. And almost like a vision board in a way for some of it, because they may not even know exactly yet what they're wanting to put together, but they've assembled vibes, per se, to be part of the experience. Like maybe colors and clothing, scenery background, and then... a blurb about an emotion or a feeling and what song they want there. So it'll be a creative storyboard. And then you build off that. And then as each department kind of gets closer to the vision, you know, you're going to go back and edit it like crazy as it gets closer. Or you might send them something and they'll be like, no, that's, we hate this. Something different, please. I mean, just like a movie score. Yeah.
Huh. That was fun. Is the choreographer involved at that point, or do they come after? The music and the video are done,
depends.
And then the choreographer?
Some of them, like for some of that stuff with Lil Nas X, they needed like the hits and things. They wanted a bunch of, you know, you got to make it exciting and give the dancers fodder for to make a routine to. So they were after, you know, okay. Bow, 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 kind of thing. So you'll send in drafts and go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth.
Huh?
Yeah.
And now, are you currently playing with the American Idol House Band?
Yes. We just did some stuff this weekend. This is my sixth season with them. Yeah.
Wow.
Great. Love that gig. Love that team. It's fun.
Is that really fast paced? Like, I mean, are you having to learn like a big batch of songs every week kind of a thing?
Let's see. Yeah. I mean, it's the most keyboarding I do anymore is on American Idol, as like playing as a keyboardist, you know?
Okay.
Cause when I'm doing production or music directing stuff from home, you know, you're clicking in the piano roll. Okay. Drag that out, drop in this sample here. Not, you know, as far as like the volume of songs, yeah, when it starts out early, because, you know, they start out with a billion contestants and they narrow it down.
All right.
At the beginning, there's no band. They're just playing for the judges and a cappella or on their instruments. And they narrowed it down to, we played for 54 people this last weekend. So wow. There's 54 songs, which is that'll be the most of the season. And then progressively, they'll get down to 25 and then 20 and then 15. And then like they get to 10 contestants and then they each start doing two songs. And as like when it starts out, it's just like getting through the songs because I think they get like 90 seconds each. And then later in the season, you know, it gets up to like a 2-minute song. And so then the production element kind of builds up too. And that's when we start adding orchestrations and I do a lot of the track building for that too. Especially if there's like orchestral stuff, you know, where we can't pull that off on stage with a rock band. So, it's a lot of fun.
So then, I didn't even realize that they don't sing the full song. They sing whatever, like you said, 90 seconds of a song.
Yeah.
Who decides what 90 seconds that's going to be?
Oh, yeah. Well, the music department, there's the band, Christopher Pooley, again, I work with Chris a lot. He's the music director for the show. And he's the head of the department. So under him is the band and there's accompanists which work with the artists, the contestants. And there's vocal coaches that work with the contestants. And the vocal coaches and accompanists, they figure out with the contestants what your song choice is going to be. Because the contestants will, you know, want to do this song or that song depending on the mood of the week. Okay. They want to show off their skills in a certain way. You know, somebody will do a Whitney Houston song and somebody will do a Keen song or whatever. Yeah. So they decide on the tune, the key, the arrangement. And we get charts actually on Idol, thankfully. So I have an iPad and it's like a lead sheet. And there'll be hits and bits there. And then we go home and do our homework, the band, and like... I'll listen to the original and figure out, okay, what are the sounds for this? And sometimes they do them totally different. Like, say it's a full EDM track, but they do it like an acoustic broke down something.
Okay.
So that the accompanists and the vocal coaches decide that with the contestants. And then it moves to the band, and then we play that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so the band sort of collectively decides the arrangement? We kind of get the general idea from the accompanist and the vocal coach?
Chris is definitely the point on that. He's the decider.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he's like, okay, this is what the artist and the vocal coach are saying. We're going to do it this way.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Huh. And I mean,
again, he's the like, as I was saying before with music directors, he's translating, you know, to everybody else what the image is. Because he talks to the producers too and the directors. So there's, you know, there's all these different things that get coordinated up there and then filters down to us. So I'm a keyboardist and I do tracks on that gig. So
okay.
Yeah. And I don't do playback. I'll just generate some of the tracks from home. We have a dedicated playback person, Laura Escudé, who like with the redundant systems and working with the TV crews and everything. That's a whole, you know, that's a whole job. So.
And are you guys able to kind of hammer through these songs pretty easily, or do you sometimes run into ones that are genuinely challenging for a pro like yourself?
This is the sixth season now, so we've gotten the gist of it more and more each time. I remember the first season, it was like, oh boy, how are we going to handle this? Because it's TV too, so it's a different dynamic than a live show. And definitely different than a record. It's there's a TV energy. You know, like 5 seconds of silence on TV is a cemetery. It's just deafening. And there's certain things that would work in the room with like a rock band energy that just won't work on TV because, you know, somebody in the Midwest is watching it in their living room, not in front of a PA, but, you know, off their TV. So there was a learning experience there for me through what works and what doesn't.
I've noticed like whenever I watch the bands playing on SNL, I'll notice that like sometimes it just does not hit at all, or it sounds bizarre coming out of the TV, even though I know like, oh, I love that person's recording, or I've seen them live, they're great, this doesn't sound good. Like how do you kind of overcome that challenge of getting something to sound good on TV?
Yeah, boy, that's a good question. There's because after part of the process is that, you know, after it gets away from the band, then there's the TV mixers who do EQ compression stuff to translate it to TV, you know, and they're the professionals at that. And so the vocal has to be, the vocal's like all the way up here, you know. Okay. Whereas like, and maybe in a live show, it'd be like, you know, bands here, vocals here, like the vocal's like all the way up front on SNL, as you notice. So yeah, those strokes that would work with subtlety in a live show. I think subtlety just does not function as well on TV.
Okay. Makes sense.
I'm definitely not the master of it. But yeah, learn more each year. So
that's cool.
And like a certain frequency things that will just mush out or not be legible audibly. And then certain things that'll just poke out big time, like a tambourine will just cut like nobody's business. And then like a beautiful like viola line, not a chance. Yeah, it'll just turn into mush.
Is everything mic'd in a way that, like you said, the TV mixer can kind of take care of those problems, or sometimes you just sort of get what you get?
Yeah, well, and they're handling, that's a whole nother, they're a whole nother thing, because they're handling not only the band, but the, you know, there's 1,000 different mics on a TV situation. So they're making frequency decisions based off of that too. So, and then like commonly will if there's an acoustic instrument that maybe is weak to be mic'd, like a violin or something like that would be difficult in a live situation on a moving set to like mic up and check. Like so many things could go wrong. So most of the time we pre-record their part with them like that morning or the day before, and then they'll mime to it. That's all over the place. Yeah. Actually, yeah. Super Bowl, Olympics. Pretty common. Yeah. Because it's like a logistics thing. You know, as a musician, at first when I heard that years ago, I was like, oh, well, that's such a drag. But like, once you see the apparatus, you're like, oh, there is no way that could, like, of course you're going to pre-record it. not a chance. Yeah, this 20-piece orchestra, you know, is not going to walk out in 10 seconds, sit down, okay, get hooked up, play the song, and then walk off. Like, otherwise, you just hear like, you know. So that's, it's pretty common. Yeah.
All right. That makes sense.
They're playing. They just played it like the day before, you know.
Yeah. They're not like fake violinists, like hired actors. Now you're doing a lot of scoring, like commercial composing. Like, you've done stuff for like Chevy, Apple, BMW, things like that. Is that a lot of what you're doing right now?
Yeah. And a lot of the music directing stuff has been more scoring-esque. Like the Lil Nas X thing this summer was pretty much scoring. So yeah, I really enjoy scoring because I get to be at home too. And it's just a different brain than like playing keys. So I enjoy it a lot. Yeah.
And that seems a little less adjacent. Like, I can see how like touring and gigging and American Idol and studio work would kind of feed into each other. But now you're working with like corporate clients. So like, how'd you kind of get connected into that part of the industry?
Let's see. Can't remember.
It's just a random.
It's a different scene and it's different people. It's a different way to make money. I guess I started doing it actually on the road in hotel rooms. Because I'd get hit up for stuff and then I would be able to like work on stuff at night at the hotel, or on the tour bus. And then, you know, it's like you're balancing, you know, multiple plates to make a living. So I started doing little bits like that for commercials and things like that. And then it grew into more.
Is the studio
you're in the box stuff.
Okay.
In the computer, I don't know your crowd, but like at home here, I've got, you know, a billion keyboards, hardware keyboards, and devices. But yeah, the fast pace of scoring stuff. I keep a lot of stuff like virtual because they'll come back with a change, and you know, if it's acoustically recorded, then changing that is more time consuming, and problematic, but. If it's in the box, then you can just, you know, we'll change the tempo here. We'll shorten that note. Done. Send. You know,
same way.
Now.
So if you're using virtual instruments, it's just a matter of changing the MIDI, not having to re-record the track.
Tone or, yeah. Okay. Or maybe cutting off the tail with, you know, changing the filter cutoff on it, whatever. So.
Now, for our listeners, we're talking about creating music in the box, which means creating music in your computer using software known as a DAW. And there's many components to this process, one of which is, of course, composing the actual notes that the instruments and plugins will play. If this is something you're interested in learning how to do, I highly recommend another super effective course of ours called Building Blocks. It'll take you step by step through the process of writing the building blocks of beats, drum patterns, bass lines, chord progressions, and melodies. And it all takes place in an actual online DAW where you create music as you go. And for our loyal podcast listeners, you can get 20% off Building Blocks this month using coupon code DIRECTOR. Check it out at audiblegenius.com/buildingblocks.
Now, are there times where you're like, well, no, I know it's going to be harder if there's a change, but I need to use hardware.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't know if you can see in the shot, probably not.
I can.
But, yeah. I am a hardware synth guy in many ways, but I'm not anti software at all. I use so many plugins. but yeah, there's certain things that I definitely turn to in this room that like, I know how they speak, what their voice is, and I go to them for something specific because it's got that, you know, whatever between me and it. So yeah, it just depends on the situation. There's my Prophet 6. It does a thing and I work really fast on it. And so I'll commonly build stuff with plugins, like the shell of it. And then I can rip one of those over the top or do a synth bass on it. So that, I feel like that helps having just a little bit of that voodoo. Then you introduce the problems, of course, of having an acoustically recorded, not acoustic per se, but you know, instrument that is not a plugin, that's just audio, and then you got to edit it or change it. But I'm okay with that price of entry there.
Do you ever layer the hardware synth on top of a virtual?
Yes, definitely. And like, I tend to, if I was to generalize, I turn to the plugins for like the sheeny shiny stuff, the gloss, mm-hmm. and the width, and the glassy brightness, which, you know, is that's clarity. And then this stuff I turn to like the dark, murky, muddy, thick. And then if you get those two together, then I like that. Yeah. Because otherwise one's too brittle sometimes and the other can just be, if you layer too many profits, it's just going to be obnoxiously fat and illegible. Yeah. Like, this thing sounds great. No, it sounds terrible. You need to get rid of at least 12 of those tracks.
But it's an analog synth.
Yeah.
It must sound great.
I used to be more of a purist about that years ago, but now, yeah.
There's, purist as in I'll only do analog or
use hardware.
Okay.
And, right. You know, if you're not using this, then it's not real. That's not technology now. It's both. It's a hybrid. Everything's a hybrid. Yeah. So, yeah. Need a hybrid car, you know. So.
Right. Now, when you're composing these ads, do you get the finished commercial? Like, here it is.
It depends. Some of them are storyboards, or they'll just be creative prompts. Some of these Chevy ads are old, so I can say this, but they'd have like a single sheet of paper per se that has like shots from their old commercials that'll be like setting up the scene, and they'll have the like draft of dialogue. And they'll be like, okay, shot opens here. The narrator guy talks to these car customers and they ask these questions about things they want, say in a car or whatever. And then the next card will be, well, actually the new Chevy, whatever, has this and this and this. And then the third card will be like, oh, well, that's great. Does it have this? And then the fourth card will be like, yeah, well, in fact, it won the J.D. Power Overdrive Award for the last 10 years on the Chevy, da-da-da, you know. So it won't be made, but there will be the gist of it. And commercials are going to be, they're going to be either 30 seconds or a minute. It's going to be that.
Exactly?
Yeah, and then after that, the music editor for them is going to dice it up just however it needs to work. Like, so they'll get the stems from us of everything we did, and say they need to cut it down to like a 15 or whatever, say a YouTube ad or something, and they'll just, you know, make it work.
So. Well, that's interesting. So will you typically say maybe make a minute? And then that gives them plenty to work with if they need to trick it down.
You want to give them plenty to work with, yeah, because if there's not enough, then they don't have any material and they're going to go get somebody else. So, yeah.
And is it just a general feel they're looking for, or do they also need like timestamp moments? Like, I need the music to change this way.
There'll be moments. And it depends on the ad or the event, but like, say on one of the Chevy ones, it was like the dynamic would just have to need to ratchet up as each like element of the product is released, you know, told to the audience, there needs to be like a little more excitement. And eventually there, because if you start here, then it's just going to stay there, which some other ads are like that. Say it's like it's 15 seconds about a super killer truck or something, you know, like the new Ford, da da da. It's just going to be like da na 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 da da, you know, it's the whole time because it's this short. But if it's a minute long, that's going to be monotonous. And if there's dialogue, you have to make room for the dialogue. You can't be slamming music over the dialogue. So, you pace it with that.
And you know, you've got this wall of keyboards behind you and around you. Do you ever do anything with, say, like guitars or?
I do. I'm a other terrible live guitarist. Instrument.
Okay.
Yeah. I play a little bit of bass. It's always going to be like driven, played with a pick. But yeah, I enjoy some of that, so that there's like a little non-syntheticness in there when I can muster it. I use a lot of contact libraries too that have great guitars or orchestra. And there's some great bass plugin ones too. So I use those a lot.
Because I ask, because I wonder, like, do the companies, like, say, go to you or some other composer because you have a particular sound? Like, if they wanted something really guitar heavy, would they hire you, or they hire some guy who's known for being guitar heavy or something like that?
Good question. I think it depends. The things I've gotten have all been, again, to go back to my Mariah edition, were all connections. Somebody I knew somebody who knew somebody. So you were, but they, I mean, they know several people. So maybe you're a pool of 7 or 10 people that they would turn to.
Okay.
That they can trust. Because you got to think, like, from their perspective, say there's a director who has a product or an ad campaign, like, they're not going to, that's not when they're going to be like, let's take a chance, you know, we got infinite time and budget. Let's go find somebody new. It's like, music is going to always be like the last thing that's thought of. And they're like, we need this in 4 days. So it's like, these people can get it done and deliver something good. So we're going to go with them. Huh. So yeah, building relationships, which I could definitely stand to have 1,000 more relationships. Sure. But yeah, with directors and producers and things like that, help. I never did this, but I heard from several other people that have been scoring people, like scoring as a job their whole career. They started off like going to school, and like I did with the bands, they'd go find a director in the film department who was like their age, and they'd play for their documentary for free or whatever, you know. And so then you build relationships with these people, and then when they eventually get their gig, then they're going to call you because you already have that rapport there, as opposed to like a cold call, something or other. So
That's interesting.
I haven't done that, but I've heard that from several peers that's how they started. So
okay. Now, you've also done recording studio work, like working with artists and stuff like that. Like some big acts there were like Avicii and Flo Rida and a whole other list of others. And looking at your different credits, you had a lot of different roles. Like sometimes you're playing keyboards, sometimes you're co-writing, production, programming, you know. Is your role in any given studio session clearly defined beforehand? Like, we want you to come in and do programming, or is it a bit more fluid and organic?
It's usually... in most things I did and do, it starts from keyboards and kind of blooms out into the other stuff. So most of the time, it's related to keyboards, definitely. Like the Avicii thing, I was just called in to be like the keyboardist with Alla Black, who I was touring with at the time.
Like,
I'd like to have you with me because this is a new situation, and I was like a. I was one of the band leaders. There's two of us. And so it was a comfort thing. And then it turned into like, well, now we're writing together because in the room, the situation changed. And then me and Avicii, who we were together, like bent over a laptop and like both like editing and looking in there and looking at the piano roll and you know, making edits and decisions together. Like then you're into like production. So, and then in some other bands I've been in, I bring synths with me to record, but then we're all producers in some of those situations. So, but we know it going in. We're all like, there's the guitarist, one of my best buddies. He's a producer as well in that situation. I'm a keyboardist and I'm a producer in that situation. And then there's a producer keyboardist who's like more the lyrics guy. So. Those roles were, I guess we come with our expectations and whatnot, but, certain situations bloom into other ones.
Yeah. There is so much overlap, right?
There is.
Producers play keyboards and,
absolutely.
You know, what is writing?
Every producer kind of plays keyboards in a way. So, they all seemed like natural evolutions. Cause I started off on keys and then kind of started getting into production and learning more about that. You know, I'm picking up more about that craft, but I came in as a keyboardist. Same with music directing. I started out just playing keys in the band, and then situations came up where they're like, oh, we we need help with this thing. And then you're thrown into the fire and you got to figure it out. So
again, you're there.
Yeah.
You're prepared.
Yes.
And you just, you're flexible and you're like, hey, let's do it.
Yeah, let's figure it out. Yeah.
Do you ever find yourself in a room with like a ton of producers or writers, or just like a lot of involvement from a lot of people, almost like a party in a sense?
I've been in some of those. Yeah.
Yeah. Is that just chaos or what does that look?
Some folks like to do it that way. I don't particularly because, you know, it's the too many cooks in the kitchen sort of thing. Right. And, everybody's clamoring to get their voice onto it. Wow. In a way, whether driven by ego or not, you know, like you're going to say if I'm in a room with eight other producers, like whatever I do is going to be my voice, of course. So musically, so if everybody's trying to build, then it just can kind of turn into glop.
Yeah. That just sounds stressful to me.
It gets stressful. I don't particularly like those situations, but, it depends. Since I do like, I'm a hands-on producer, like I like to be in the DAW, like clicking around and stuff like that. I don't like to, you know, or like add a synth, like let's get into it. Other producers will not touch anything. They'll be sitting on the couch, like speaking all their stuff or singing.
Okay.
You know, so I like to be in the situations where we can all kind of get into the DAW-ness. I'm pointing at my laptop right now, but yeah, we're all part of that experience. 'Cause that's where I come from, you know, is the DAW from Ableton or Logic, and like getting your hands in there, as part of the process.
Now, is there anywhere you want to go in the future in terms of something you haven't learned yet or a part of the industry you haven't explored?
I would like to do a lot more scoring. I really enjoy scoring and I've done it more and more. I like the short form scoring, like ads. And I've, the past couple of years I've worked as a, I've worked with some composers for movies and, helped with like sound design, or I'll record this stuff here, which has its character. And then they'll have like the orchestration part. So then they get both. And, I really enjoy that a lot. So I would, endeavor to do more of that.
Now, is there anything you're saying a lot of times, just, you know, saying yes to things, being in the room, it's who you know, but there's certain things you can kind of do to try to sort of steer your path in that direction that are under your control?
Relationships, I think. Yeah. 'Cause again, people call who they know, people work with who they know, who they trust, or, You don't call somebody who you just have no idea about. You know, when I refer somebody to substitute for me, like I'm only referring people that I trust to be able to handle the work. So it's still just relationships when it comes down to it. American Idol, Chris Pooley, music director, he got the gig as the music director, and he put me on because he knows me and knows that I would be a good part of the team. He didn't just get like a keyboardist, so. Directors work with people they know and such. So I would, any ways to get to know people that are more in that lane would be the way to control that. And also then, getting better on your own all the time. That's always in your own control.
So along with your music skills, you got to maintain and nurture your social skills.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Nobody's working in isolation here. Well, yeah, not anymore. But yeah. It's something I notice often. As soon as I go have a hang with somebody or a coffee or a friend, we'll see each other at a thing or whatever, invariably we're working together within the next couple months, because
really,
I don't know if it's something cosmic or if it's just like, oh yeah, I remember Peter exists. Let's put him on this thing, you know, like that's just how it goes. Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah.
Well, Peter, thank you so much. This is great for people to just kind of see what it's actually like working in that part of the industry and kind of the openness of it, the fluidity of it, and
it's wide smattering of a keyboard career. So
you definitely do it. So thanks again for being on the show. This is really fascinating.
Great. Thanks, Joe.
No problem.
Thanks for listening to the Audible Genius podcast. Now, as you listen to these musicians' stories, you may find yourself wanting to make your own music. Or maybe you already can, but you feel the need to brush up on fundamentals, fill in some gaps. Well, I've got some super effective and engaging courses that help aspiring digital musicians find their voice and create music they love. And these courses are more than just a series of videos. They have interactive challenges in a music software environment where you actually create music as you go and get real experience. The first course I recommend is Building Blocks, where you'll learn beat composition and music theory in an online music studio. Check it out at audiblegenius.com. We also have Syntorial, an award-winning course on synthesis, where you'll learn how to create your own sounds with a synthesizer. Check that out at syntorial.com. And both of these courses are designed by yours truly and the team here at Audible Genius. So if you've ever had a desire to make your own music, I highly encourage you to check them out. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode.